All right, so as usual, any questions from last week? Speak quickly. You're supposed to have these all ready to go. No. Any questions from the reading? I hope you people enjoyed the historical stuff as much as I did. I thought in particular the account of the litigation with the stationer's company basically trying to rig the litigation in order to get the result they obviously wanted was really quite neat. And it's also fun because it's one more example of the tension that we've seen running through the theory all the way along between thinking of IP as a natural right, as something which it is sort of a imposition on the author not to protect the IP, and seeing it as something that the state gives you for prudential reasons, but where insofar as there's an imposition, it's an imposition on the potential copyist not to allow him to copy. And that was really quite neat, and you could see the arguments on both sides being made back then, just as in the 19th century they're made in the patent case, but here this was in the 18th century, which, as I say, I thought was quite fun. One other thing, which probably nobody but me was picking up on, was the discussion of Venetian copyright, mentioned that one of the early people to get copyright was Ariosto. Does anybody here know who Ariosto is? No particular reason you should, unless you. Ariosto is the author of one of the most famous works of Italian literature, the Orlando Furioso. The interesting thing is that the Orlando Furioso is an unauthorized sequel to a previous famous poem, the Orlando Innamorato. So that if Boiardo, who was the author of the Innamorato, had modern copyright protection, almost certainly Ariosto, who actually got one of the early copyrights, would have been an infringer. Under current law. I don't think that the Venetian law that early actually worried about derivative works. But it's sort of interesting because one of the questions we'll be coming to later is to what degree the protection of one person's IP interferes with the production of IP by somebody else. And here we have a case, there must be other cases, but it's the only case I can think of a famous work of literature which was a sequel to somebody else's. Let me think about that. But it's by the same person. You could argue that the Odyssey is a sequel to the Iliad, but they're both, as far as we know, written by Homer, of whom we know very little, so it could have been two authors, but we don't think it was. Are there any other examples, any of you with a literature, background in literature, of famous works of literature that were derivative works in the... There are some translation cases. Presumably another thing probably none of you have any ever reason to have heard of is the Kalila wa Dimna, which is a famous work of Arabic literature, which is an Arabic translation of a Persian translation of a Sanskrit original with various changes occurring during the process. So I guess that would be coming close. And I don't know if there are other examples or not. But anyway, I just thought it was sort of interesting of you. And as I say, we'll be coming back to that later, but it is an issue which to the... Reading didn't join them, but if you look at it, two of the things we read, the discussion by Lippmann and the discussion by Landis and Posner, are both really raising the same issue, namely that if you have too much protection of existing IP, IP is an input to as well as an output from the production of things like books, and therefore you have a potential conflict. And I thought that was sort of interesting. All right. So... We have two different moral intuitions, as it were, about IP in general and about copyright in particular. And one moral intuition is the author has created this. He's injured nobody else in the process. It's coming out of his work in his head. It therefore intuitively belongs to him, just the way a lot of us feel that if you make something, it's yours. All right? Therefore, that argument would seem to imply that even without any special copyright legislation, the author ought to have a natural right to it. And that was the Stationer's argument, basically. And you can look at it in a Lockean sense that the author has mixed his labor with whatever he had available with the potential books to be written. The alternative view of the matter is to say, I've got this book here. I bought it, fair and square. You could have kept it secret if you wanted to, but you didn't bother. Since it's mine, I can do what I like with it, including copying it. All right? But it is arguably useful to reward authors by having a temporary monopoly. I'm curious how many people, let's take the first one, how many people's gut reaction on this issue is that the first version is more or less right? That it's really a natural right? Yes? One, got at least two brave people. Great. How many people's gut reaction is the other way, that there is no natural right and it's just a prudential thing justified only if it has good consequences because the default ought to be that you're free to copy books? Right. All right. Interesting. Because I have both intuitions. I mean, that's part of what I find intriguing about the situation. And I observed this a long time ago. As probably many of you know, I'm a libertarian politically, and one of the sort of neat things if you read libertarian arguments is that all libertarians are confident what the right answer is to the IP question. It's just that half of them think one of them is the right answer and half of them think the other. That Ayn Rand, who I suppose is one of the most influential modern authors in that tradition, clearly thought that IP was a natural right. A different way of putting it, suppose there were no IP law, and suppose an author says to you, I will sell you this book, I'm selling this book in general, and I ask people not to make copies without my permission, or not make copies without sending me a 25-cent donation. How many people would feel morally obliged to abide by that request? Morally, yeah. All right.
It depends kind of on the friction.
Yeah, and it's also partly a contract argument then. But you can imagine the case where somebody sells it in those terms, and you know he does, but you got your copy out of the library. So, or your copy was one that somebody had thrown away and you got out of the trash. So you have never made the agreement. All right, this is, in a sense, one of the problems if you try to think of IP from a contract standpoint. If all contracts were costlessly perfectly enforceable, you wouldn't need IP law. Right? Because in that world, when I publish my book, I say to everybody who buys it, by buying it, you are consenting to not make copies or not allow anybody else to make copies. Anybody who gets your book and does make copies is, in effect, violating the contract you've made with me. He's whatever the technical term is for what cost Texaco such a fortune, inducing breach of contract. So that world, you don't really need it. And from that, sure, from an economist standpoint, one way of looking at IP is to say, well, it's a imperfect substitute for the contracts that a full freedom of contract world would have if only we could enforce them. Anyway, let's go on to a slightly different question, but one which is related to that. Whether if you look at the form of the law, not just modern copyright law, but various of the versions we've seen described in this, whether that form is evidence of whether the law thinks of it as a natural right or as prudential. So that, for example, one of the claims that I think was made, and one of the things by somebody we read, I don't remember which of the people it was, is that the existence of formalities, the fact that it used to be the case that you weren't protected by copyright unless you had a copyright notice on your work, or sometimes unless you had deposited a copy. I assume people know at the moment that everything that you produce in any nailed down form, in a recording or writing, whatever, is automatically copyrighted under U.S. law. That registering is relevant to your legal recourse, that you basically have stronger claims against infringers if you've registered than if you haven't. I believe somebody who knows more about it can correct me, but I think the current rule is that you can get actual damages without registration, but the statutory damages, which are a fixed amount that don't require you show it actually hurt you, require registration. But it used to be the case in the U.S. and various other places you had formalities. Does that show that the law is assuming that it's not a natural right but a government-granted right? Are there formalities with ordinance?
I think it's treating it more like a natural right.
It could be a natural right.
Because as soon as you're allowing copyright to exist, as soon as it's in a physical form, then that would...
Well, that's our modern system, and I want to go back to the point, back to the point where you had to have a copyright notice. And the question is, is that good evidence that the legal system thinks of it as merely a state-created right or not? Think about other cases. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. Don't be so quick, because think about property rights in land. That after all, I can't, at least I think it is true in at least some states, that I can't object to your trespassing if I had no trespasser signs on. that if I don't mark the boundaries of my land, I think it is the case, and I'm sure it varies with states and countries and such, that failing to mark the boundaries of my land is going to limit my rights against people who violate those boundaries. Yep. Yep. That's right. Yes. Right. So the one way of putting it, one way of looking at it, is that even if you believe in a natural right, you would say, I've got to give the potential violator the information needed to know that I'm claiming this natural right. That after all, this book, some books were written 500 years ago, and, you know, everybody knows no one is seriously. But more than that, think about adverse possession in property law. All right, adverse possession essentially says that if you don't maintain your claim by, for example, complaining when somebody else builds a house on your land, after a while it stops being your land. All right, that's what the doctrine of adverse possession is. So it seems to me that if you actually look at the argument that was being made, it seemed to me was an overstated argument in the sense of the existence of formalities or the fact that under some circumstances you can abandon it is not very strong evidence on which side you interpret it. Now, I think it is true that if you look at the Constitution, the language of the Constitution certainly suggests that the reason is in order to encourage certain things and doesn't really say whether it's in any other sense justified or not justified. But we'll get into it later, but in a sense, some of the arguments that we're seeing made are arguments which say, well, if it is a natural right, it's not quite clear what it is because you didn't really create it out of nothing at all. You really created it out of fragments of ideas that other people had. And we'll be getting back to that later. Let me go on to a different point, but one which struck me reading some of the early stuff. And that is, you're an author and you've written a book. What are the different rights that you might want to have with regard to that book that you might care about, and in each case for what reason? All right, if you are making a list, you're a wish list, all right, you're an author, and like most authors, you really feel the book is yours, whether or not you've got a good argument for it. It's mine, therefore, what things can't other people do? Yeah? Copied is the easy one, and copying, the obvious reason for that is that you want to be able to make money out of it. All right, if you don't, I mean, I put stuff up on the web all the time, and, you know, one of my standard phrases is that when you're young, you're afraid people will steal your ideas, and when you're old, you're afraid they won't. So from that standpoint, if what you want is to have your book read, you'd say copying is wonderful, all right? I've got, what, about 4 or 5 books up on the web to be read for free, as well as books that are sold, because I want people to read them. So that's one thing you might write. What else might you want? Yeah? You might want to control the realm. You might want to say other people can't take my world and put their people into it. That's right. And one of the reasons you might feel that is an interesting case because it isn't just proprietary in that sense. Let's suppose you've got a world and you've got characters and they're real to you and you care what happens to them. So if somebody else writes a book, if somebody else does exactly what Ariosto did, he continues Boiardo's story with the same characters. All right? Orlando and Amoroso. Orlando, by the way, is the Italian version of Roland, for people who are familiar with the Chasseur de Roland, which is early medieval French literature, heroic literature at the court of Charlemagne. And then the Italian authors do a sort of almost spoof of it. They're turning it into an early version of fantasy fiction, somewhat tongue-in-cheek. In the Orlando Furioso, for example, it's very dangerous to take a drink because there are, as far as I can know, there are only 3 kinds of sort of fountains, wells in the world of Orlando Furioso. One of them takes away your memory. One of them makes you hate whoever you loved most. And one of them makes you fall in love with the next living creature you see. They're plot devices, right? So it's weird and sort of interesting stuff. My daughter, by the way, who's an Italian major and can read this stuff in the original, tells me that the Orlando Innamorato, the original, which I've never read, is really good and very funny. But I have read the Furioso in translation, and it's entertaining in lots of ways. The story, by the way, if you ever want to read it, there's an early a 16th century verse translation of which the story is supposed to be that one of the courtiers at Queen Elizabeth's court translated the canto of the Orlando Furioso, whose theme was the impossibility of keeping women faithful to their husbands, and circulated it around the court. And Elizabeth, as a punishment, condemned him to translate the rest of it. And it's a good translation. There's a 19th century verse translation that's much more literal and not nearly as good. But anyway, long digression. So in any case, so one thing you might want to do is to control that imaginary world. And certainly I feel that way. I mean, I've written a couple of novels, and I don't want to have people take my characters and have them do things that are wrong, that I see as wrong. I wouldn't even want to have them kill off my characters, right? I'm a softie. That's one of my weaknesses as a writer. I'm very reluctant to kill off characters I like. I don't want anybody else to do it, too. So that would be an interesting, different thing you would like to control, your imaginative creation, as it were. Other things, or other things related to that. What's the biggest thing that academics want to control?
Attribution.
That's right. From the standpoint of an academic, piracy is a minor misdeed, but plagiarism, you know, that's a deadly sin. There's a good discussion, there's a book on basically norms and enforcement of norms by Robert Ellickson, a Yale law professor. The book is called Order Without Law, and it's really about the way in which you get the equivalent of the effect of law without law through private norms. But one of the things he discusses is the norms of his own community, the academic community. Now, maybe it's less true now, because there's, I think, over the last 20 years, there's been an increased push to force academics not to violate copyright law. But it used to be, I think, pretty much taken for granted that it was legitimate to photocopy 20 copies of someone else's article and distribute them to your students. And now I think if I want to do that, I've actually got to get permission to probably pay some small sum. And since I'm on both ends of that transaction, I'd rather have it not enforced myself, because the nuisance is more relevant than the money. On the other hand, if you publish an article which was written by somebody else with your name on it, if you're a professional academic, that's the deadly sin. That's the crime which people will not forgive. So in that particular world, and of course it makes sense, because that's a world, academics aren't paid for most of what they write. All right, depends. If you write a book, you can get royalties. But only there are really sort of two kinds of books academics write. There are textbooks, and a really successful textbook can make you a lot of money, but that's very rare. I mean, you know, there are, let me guess that in economics, there are probably maybe five people, of whom I'm not one of them, and I've written textbooks, who make a significant income from their textbooks. And then there are scholarly books. And scholarly books, you know, you get royalties, but they're basically trivial royalties under most circumstances. So that's not why you write them. The reason you write them is some combination of the same reason you write articles. Articles, in some scientific fields, you pay to have an article published. In physics, you have page charges, which normally your university pays, not out of your pocket. But if you publish a law review article, my guess is they pay you nothing. I won't swear to it. There may be cases where they give you a token payment. And there are some places where if you referee an article, they give you $50 or something. But basically, it's all being done for free. And why is it being done? Well, if you're an assistant professor and you want to get tenure, how do you do it? You publish articles in good journals. And at the next and more important level, if you're a scholar in a field and you want to matter, you want to affect the field, how do you do it? You think of interesting and original ideas, and you spread them among your colleagues so that you'd like the credit for it. You know, it's less important to have the credit than to have done it, I think. There's a Kipling poem, which is really about that, although it's an entirely different context. It's set someplace like Australia. It's not, he never makes it clear, but some newly settled land. And this person is describing how they're living sort of on the coast. It's the edge of cultivation. Beyond that mountain range, nobody goes, and he goes. And he almost dies, and he explores, and he comes back. I'm not the one who'll get the credit. The ones who'll get the credit are the people who followed me, a dozen men together, never knew my terrors. So I named the pass despair. It's the railway gap today now. It's really quite a neat poem. You can look it up if you want. But it's really about the same issue, because what he's saying is what was important was what he did, not whether he was credited. But academics want the credit, partly for entirely mundane reasons, such as getting tenure and getting better positions and so forth. So that's a different thing you might want. And you could certainly imagine a legal order where there was no copyright law, but were very strong rules against plagiarism. What else might you want? Might be very important to you. About what other kind of control over your own writing? Suppose somebody writes, publishes an edition of my book and adds stuff to it that I don't believe. All right? They could make me say all sorts of things. Could do it intentionally. Could do it unintentionally. They could just think of a typo that leaves out the word not. All right? And that reverses the meaning of a sentence. I've seen it often enough. If you ever give a public talk and you get a transcript of it, you will find yourself saying the opposite of what you meant from time to time, just in ordinary spoken English, because you're careless. Or you change a sentence in the middle of the sentence, and you know what you're saying, but the text doesn't know what you're saying. So another thing that might be very important to you is to control the form in which your writing appears. You might, from the copyright standpoint, want to make sure that it's... It's going to mix a bunch of things. Somebody else could claim to have written it itself. That's plagiarism. Someone could be making money out of it. That's copyright piracy. But somebody also could be perfectly honestly, right? Imagine there is somebody who agrees with my general political views, but not exactly, or doesn't understand them very well. And he writes an edition of my book, which he's edited. You know, he's fixed it. I still remember the editor of my first book insisting that I must mean that housing shortages caused rent control, not that rent control caused housing shortages. She wasn't an economist. To the economist, it's obvious that you control a price below its market level. Quantity demand is larger than quantity supplied. That gives you a shortage. She was thinking of it the other way around, that there's a housing shortage. That's a problem, so they put on a price control. But if she had edited it and I had nothing to do with it, I would have ended up saying something very different than what I intended. And as I say, you can easily enough imagine one of the reasons that I use Google to check online for people who are mentioning me is so that if somebody misquotes me, I can correct it. I've had somebody quote a long chunk he attributed to me and it was from somebody else. Just an honest mistake. And so you can see why if you're thinking about author's control, and some of this is getting into a real legal issue, much more in Europe than in the U.S., and that's what are called moral rights. The idea, my favorite moral rights story, when I was at University of Chicago Law School, the University of Chicago Law School building was built by a famous architect whose name, or designed by a famous architect whose name I forget. And it was later expanded. And one day I pick up the law school student newspaper, and there is a story that the heirs of the architect are suing under moral rights to make the law school put it back the way it was. And it took me a while to realize this was the April 1st issue. But that's a moral rights kind of argument. And again, you can certainly see the intuition of the artist or the author who says, I want my stuff uninjured. And in that case, you know, I would argue it's a contract issue, that if the architect wants to insist on that as part of the terms of the contract, he can, but he may not get as many customers that he lets them modify it later. But you could certainly see, again, especially in a world without copyright, that a different issue would be, can you take my book, modify it, and publish it either over my name or not over my name? Either way, might be an issue. So those are all relevant things that I think are worth sort of thinking about when you're thinking about these issues, and we tend not to. We're really focusing on the first one, on the ability to control copying, which is certainly one important issue, but not the only important issue. All right, let me go on to say a little bit about a puzzle that's intrigued me for a long time with regard to IP, and that is why countries that are consumers, that consume much more IP than they produce, ever agree to enforce IP law. All right. Suppose you're China, and especially suppose you're China 20 years ago. It's a little bit less true now. And you, if you're honest, realize that technologically you're decades behind the cutting edge of technological development. That you're basically a third world country, even though you've got some, you know, advanced bits in you. So then why in the world would you enforce patent law? Wouldn't the obvious sensible thing to be say, look, if we go to the U.S. and say, we'll enforce your patents if you enforce ours, We'll be paying them a lot of money, and they'll be paying us very little money because we're not going to have very many patents. So let's be pirates instead. All right. Now, sometimes it happens. As the book mentions, that was the U.S. position until early in the 20th century, basically, that the U.S. Was not a signatory to any of these agreements. And I think it's pretty clear that part of the reason was that if you think about the situation up to about the late 19th century, England was a much more important country, culturally speaking, than the U.S. was. All right? So therefore, since we have a common language, we have much more interest in printing their books than they have in printing our books. So therefore, even though U.S. authors might be in favor of having copyright law agreement that will protect them in England, they're not losing enough to do much lobbying, whereas the publishers and their customers in the U.S. say, well, you know, why should we be giving money all to those Englishmen? Besides, you know, they're evil people. After all, we fought the revolution against them. Snotty, too. They think they're better than we are. If you look at sort of, again, 19th century literature, English-American. But on the other hand, if you look around at the moment, I'm not sure. Taiwan, for a long time, was I think, the last pirate nation that I remember visiting there, I don't know, 30 or 40 years ago. And there were all these books in the bookstores, and they hadn't paid copyright, and they were really cheap. They were probably cheap in the other sense, too. I think they weren't very, very high-quality books because they were deliberately doing price competition. But Taiwan did eventually agree to sign on to copyright. I'm almost certain that's the case. And I think China, I don't think, has any in recent times ever refused. Now, you could argue that the right solution is to agree to IP and then just not enforce it. And people do sometimes accuse some countries of doing that, and probably there's some truth to that. On the other hand, they may also be countries which aren't very good at enforcing that sort of thing for their own people either, given that they aren't, you know, modern, highly developed countries. But anyway, but it just struck me as an interesting puzzle how you get countries, whether for literature or for inventions, how you get countries to agree to it. And it occurred to me that you could actually do an interesting research project, which I never went very far on. Because one of the things you'd like to have for doing scientific research is multiple worlds you can look at. And in the case of copyright, though not patent, we do have multiple worlds. Because almost all infringement is going to be within a language group. All right? It's true, translations are worth something. But from the standpoint of an author, if you are writing in English, copyright in places other than English-speaking countries isn't very important to you. Now, it's true, I've had books translated to Chinese, and I did calculate that if one of my books sold as well in communist China as it did in Taiwan, I would be a rich man, as well per capita, because the number of capitas is a whole lot higher in China. But I'm not counting on it. But on the whole, mostly you're interested in your own language group. So it would be an interesting project, as it were, to look at the development of copyright law in one-nation worlds. All right, Finland is pretty much a one-nation world. There's basically nobody speaks Finnish outside of Finland. Hungary is pretty much a one-nation world. Nobody speaks Hungarian out. Versus many-nation worlds, all right, which the two big many-nation worlds, I would think, would be English and Spanish. There may be some others that I'm missing, but those are cases where you've got a bunch of different countries, independent countries, all of which share a language and therefore a literature. And it would be sort of fun to see how it developed. Because in the one-nation case, it's easy to get IP rule, whereas you'd think in the many-nation case that the small nations would always want a free ride on the large nations, so to speak. Anyway. Now, the answer may be that we bully them into it. The answer may be that you go to a small country who really it's not in their interest to have to enforce our patents or our copyrights, New Zealand maybe, and we say, yes, but we won't trade with you, or we won't give you foreign aid, or we won't help you if somebody invades you, unless. And, of course, another possibility, which is interesting to look at, would be whether you get lobbying across countries. Whether you get a situation where the author's organization in the U.S. gives money to New Zealand politicians in exchange for them committing to have... Now, New Zealand, I'm sure, has had copyrights for a long time. I'm just picking them as the smallest English-speaking country that immediately occurs to me. That a very nice country, too, I should say. I visited it once. I liked it. But in any case, I don't... Does anybody know... I know in the U.S. there are occasionally sort of scandals where it's claimed that some politician has been taking money from China, usually from some foreign source. And What are the legal limits in the U.S.? Anyone know? No. I think there are some, but maybe just you have to register. But anyway, I don't know how much sort of lobbying activity actually happens across countries, because that would be another way you might get it. That the, anyway, it also just struck me as an intriguing set of issues. All right, another question which occurred to me, which isn't discussed at least at this part in the reading, but that I wanted you to think about a little bit, is whether any of the arguments we're looking about at are changed by the rise of self-publishing. That is to say, it's more or less being taken for granted in the discussion that the way a book is published is that the author makes a deal with the publisher spends a good deal of money to physically produce and distribute the book, the author gets royalties and so forth. And you occasionally see the argument made that, in fact you saw it I think in one of our readings, that the people defending copyright law always pretend to be acting for the interest of the authors, but that's really bogus. The authors have sold their rights to the publishers, and they're really acting for the publishers, who are much less sympathetic characters than the, you know, the author doing great literature in a garret or something. But nowadays, you can do your great literature and never see a publisher. All right, it's how I do not know what. It'd be very interesting to know what the data are on total revenue from self-published books versus from commercially published books nowadays. What I know, though, is that you can currently self-publish an ebook at no financial cost, and you can currently self-publish a print-on-demand physical paperback on Amazon at a trivial financial cost, because I've done both of those. And that means that you've got the possibility of a world where it really is the author without the publisher, a world where the author is, in effect, contracting with other people, hiring somebody to do a cover, for example, or paying a copy editor, that sort of thing, but where it's the author who is the self-employed person at the center of it, rather than the author being either an employee or, alternatively, somebody who, in effect, sells the right to the publisher. So that seems to me is an interesting thing you might just keep in the back of your minds when you're looking at all of this stuff. Yep.
The Guardian says 20% of what they call the genre market in 2012. So that's fiction, romance, science.
And that 20% of that was self-published.
Was self-published ebooks.
Ebooks alone. All right, because there are also self-published POD. I don't know if they're as common. That's very interesting. All right. And that's the market by revenue, presumably.
Yeah.
You'd want it by revenue, not by copies, because ebooks can be very cheap, and therefore you might have a lot of them that people buy and never read,
yeah,
or download for free and never read, for that matter. But right, so that's interesting. So that's if it's 20% already, that means in the world you people are going to be living in, it may well end up as the dominant form. And of course, in addition to all of that, there's also doing stuff online that is not as a book. If you think about blogs versus newspapers, all right, blogs are largely now fulfilling the function of newspapers, even though there's no physical paper involved in it. So in general, I mean, I think for any of you who are going to be involved in IP, one of the things you want to keep at the back of your mind, because sort of one of the interesting things is how are the technological changes of the last few decades changing that world? What's going to happen? And as I may have suggested before, if you really want to make a fortune and are very clever, the big gap in the present system is a decent filter, is a way in which readers can find books. Because if a book has been published by a commercial publisher, that doesn't tell you it's worth reading, but is at least from the top 5% of the slush pile. All right, it's at least, you know, passed a bunch of tests. The fact that I'm willing to put up a book that's a Kindle on Amazon tells you zip, right? It doesn't cost me anything. And all authors are biased to think their books are wonderful. So what one needs is a good, inexpensive mechanism by which readers can figure out which books to read. And so if you can think up that and figure out a way to sell it, you could be very rich. And I will be grateful, because then it'll tell me what books to read. Another example of wanting to give away ideas, because I'm not going to do anything with them myself, and I want to benefit by them. All right. The issue which we've really been looking at before in the patent context, but is here as well, is if you're going to have protection, how much protection should you have? And again, that's really in two different dimensions. One of them is how wide is the protection. You could imagine a patent law that covered a direct copy of my book but didn't cover a translation. that covered a direct copy but didn't cover a sequel, that covered translations, sequels, direct copies, but didn't cover somebody who took the basic ideas of my book and used them in his book, which in fact doesn't under current copyright law and so forth. So one question is how broad, and the other question is how long. And that's one of the things that Macaulay's speech that you read was about, was the question of how long. And the benefit of making protection longer is that you have a greater incentive to write books, make more money out of them. What's the cost? Well, one cost, as in all of these things, is that you're charging the royalty makes the book more expensive, or fewer people read the book, and therefore the benefit produced by it is less. But there's another cost, potentially, and that's the transaction costs, as in the patent case, so I think it's less of a problem in copyright, of the fact that somebody else, well, it's very unlikely that anybody else has to worry whether he's accidentally written your book. But you could certainly see somebody who wants to use your book for something. Let me take a perfectly real example, because it was an example I ran into. One of my hobbies is cooking for medieval cookbooks. I came across a Spanish translation, actually two different Spanish translations of two different 13th century Arabic cookbooks from Al-Andalus, from Muslim Spain. Very interesting. I got other people who shared my interests who, unlike me, knew Spanish to translate from Spanish into English. I then discovered that I was not entitled to... at this time, I was making copies of a bunch of source material and selling it at cost, more or less, to other people who were interested in medieval cooking. And I discovered that I was not entitled to do that because the retranslation from Spanish to English was covered by the copyright of the person who translated from Arabic into Spanish. Arabic copyright, I don't have to worry about. 13th century is a long time ago. But, so for one of them, I don't think for either of them that I ever succeeded in getting in touch with the copyright owner. Because it's a different country, I don't speak the language, these were done a fair while ago. Don't know if they're alive, I think one of them I discovered it wasn't alive, but who knows. One of them I got somebody who knew Arabic to go back to the original and retranslate it from that, and I've made that available for many years for people. It's up on my webpage if you're curious about what a 13th century cookbook is like. But the other one I've never been able to make available because I... All right, so that's a case where presumably the copyright holder is not injured in the least by my making it available. He's probably be in favor of it, maybe. But there are noticeable transaction costs. And if you think about the issue of what are referred to as orphan works... An orphan work is basically a work that is under copyright, but where it's not easy to find out who holds the copyright. And you can imagine lots of cases. You might want to do a book about, let us say, early 20th century literature. And what you have, well, this chapter is going to be this story, and this chapter is this story, and this chapter is this story, but each of those stories is under copyright. So you then have extra costs, which wouldn't exist if copyright was shorter, all right? And if you imagine making copyright really long, you could see how these could become a serious problem. So I think that the issue of the deadweight cost of monopoly pricing exists at all years, but that the issue of the transaction costs becomes more and more serious as time goes on, and you balance that with the argument that says the benefit and incentive becomes less and less as time goes on. That this is something which I think Macaulay gets partly right and partly wrong, but if you think about it, not very many books are selling at a significant rate 10 years after they're published. All right. If you are, you're really lucky. But that's if you. I should say nowadays authors get to engage in all sorts of time wasting by following the ratings of their book on Amazon, which shows how rapidly it's selling at the moment, which is a tempting thing to do if you're an author. But the normal rule is that if you've written a pretty successful book, it'll sell for a few years, and then you get a trickle of sales thereafter. I should say, by the way, that one of the nice things about Amazon is that trickle is much larger than it used to be. Because it used to be that once the demand gets fairly low, bookstores don't bother carrying the book. And now it goes to zero because people can't get the book. Whereas nowadays, once a book is in print, it's probably going to be in print practically forever because it doesn't cost Amazon very much to carry it. And if Amazon's got it, everybody in the more or less the world, certainly in the U.S., can get at it, and even if it's too small a trickle for a bookstore to carry it, it that's going to be enough for Amazon. Yeah?
I'm just curious,
the Amazon rating system shows you, that is there, we've got a couple of different things on Amazon. One of them is how many copies are being sold. And to some extent, self-publishers can try to game that. I heard a talk by somebody who claimed to have been near the top brief at one point, and his system was how a lot of fans we corresponded with online, and to say to them, all of you buy one copy, you know, at 1 p.m. on Friday. And since the Amazon rating is looking at a fairly short time period, you get a blip then, and the hope is that that blip shoves it up to the top of the ratings, and the other people say, aha, it's highly rated, I'll get it too. And I don't know how well it works, but that was at least his theory. So one of the things you've got to worry about if you're actually designing such a thing is how people will game it. Because authors obviously have an incentive to try to get good ratings. But the other thing with that is Amazon has that also for their Kindles at least, I guess for all their books, they've got a rating which is basically reviews, that readers review it. Again, you could game that, right? What do you do? If you're sufficiently dishonest, you write 10 different reviews under 10 different names and have 10 different email accounts to do it with, or you get some friends to do it. There was, in fact, a good deal of flap a while ago when it turned out, when it certainly looked as though the glowing review of a book by somebody I know had been written by him. Now, he claimed it was actually written by his kids, and it may be true for all I know, and with or without his knowledge. But clearly there is sort of potentials for fraud. But no, my evidence is only that I have one Kindle up. It's my second novel, and it's gotten very good reviews, not huge numbers of them, and it hasn't sold very well. So my evidence from that is that's not really a very effective method of selling. I think I have almost all 4- and 5-star reviews, but there are only like 12 of them, 14 of them, not a huge number. On the other hand, just again to digress, if you are a novelist, part of the point of publishing a novel is to get reactions from people who read it. And so one of the nice things about the Amazon system, quite aside from whether it lets other people find out, is that if you're the author, you're getting feedback. And you're saying, I'm not just talking into a black hole, so to speak. There are people out there. So that one of the nicest things in one of the reviews of my one novel was a passage which made it clear that a particular scene where I was afraid I was being too subtle, this reader had caught it. That is, this reader was saying, you know, some books you don't have to pay attention, this one you have to pay attention in this scene. And he describes the scene, and I know exactly what he's hearing. That was really nice. Let me take a different example of this whole issue of the transaction thing, and that's the Google Books project. That is, you probably know, there's been a bunch of litigation. What Google would really like to do, as far as I can tell, and I'm not sure to what extent they're going to be able to do it, is to say we are allowed to put up on the web any book whose author hasn't told us we can't. And that's, it's more elaborate than that, but that's the basic guts of what they'd like to do. And it's, as a reader, it's a very attractive idea because I'm often looking for stuff. I might well not know a book exists, but Google, I can search, right? So I discovered the book I didn't know existed. That's exactly the information I want in it. I was doing that fairly recently. Now, Google can do that now for out-of-print books. There was some controversy. I think Google had a project which I'm not sure what its current status is, where the idea was they wouldn't actually let you read the book. They would have the book up on their server. You could search. They would then show you a couple of pages around your search term, and then you could go buy the book. And their feeling, reasonable enough, was why would the publishers object to that? This is selling books for them. But I guess some publishers did, for whatever reason, object. But anyway, actually what Google wants to do, I should be fair to them, they want to put all the world's books up, and they then want, where they know who has the copyright, to share the advertising income they get by doing that with the copyright holder. And their basic view, as far as I can tell it, is that the copyright holder wants to negotiate the terms, we're willing to do that, but we want a default rule which basically says that if we don't know you object, we can do it. And there was litigation in which there was an out-of-court settlement letting them do that, And the question was, can you really rewrite U.S. copyright law by a settlement between two litigants? And I think the answer was no, you can't. So, but somebody, I'm a couple of years behind on this. I was actually a plaintiff against Google, somewhat against my inclination, but my agent wanted plaintiffs, and my agent already told me that one of the people who had already joined in it was Richard Epstein, who I know and have a high opinion of, and so I decided I was willing to do it in that case. He thought it was a bad legal decision, whatever its usefulness for readers was. But anyway, so all I'm really saying is that the whole issue of the kind of of the transaction cost kind of problem is an argument for limiting the length of the term on the grounds that the second century, so to speak, gives the author almost nothing but is a real hassle for people who want to deal with old books, or maybe even second 50 years. It's an interesting question, which I don't know if anybody's ever investigated. Suppose copyright term was much shorter. Suppose it was 20 years. How much would authors lose? And I bet they would lose very little. I may be wrong, but that's my suspicion. So one general sort of issue, which I have never seen anybody go into, but somebody ought to, is looking at possible modifications of copyright law and figuring out how much they would cost the authors. Now, of course, Disney is a different case. And, you know, Disney has a strong incentive to want to extend copyright because they've got things like Mickey Mouse that they want to keep in copyright. But if you think about it from the standpoint of the author who we usually associate with copyright law, I'd like to know if you shorten the term a lot, would that be a large or a trivial reduction in authors' revenue? If you didn't protect against derivative works, would that be a large or a small? I want to know, of all revenue that American authors get, how much of it is royalties for translations? Because I bet it's tiny, but I could be wrong. Anyway, that would be an interesting question for anybody. I'm really thinking of how you would craft a compromise between the Baldwin and Levine position, which is you shouldn't have copyright, and the Disney position, which you should have lots and lots and lots of copyright, whether there is a plausible compromise which doesn't significantly hurt authors and yet does make the system a good deal less overpaying. Now, all of this may be irrelevant because copyright law may become unenforceable anyway because of the Internet, but it's still an interesting question. All right, let me go on then to talk a bit about Ray Patterson's argument, he's distinguishing somehow between creation and distribution, and he's saying, you know, the real function of this is to get the book out there, but he doesn't, at least in the excerpt we read, ever take the next step, which is to say, and therefore, your copyright should be conditional on your making the book available. All right, you could certainly imagine a copyright regime which says use it or lose it. All right, and in fact, one of the interesting issues, going back to the question of length of term, is maybe the right compromise. So you get 20 years, and another 20 years if you're willing to pay $500. And another 20 years after that, if you're willing to pay $100. It's some not huge sum, on the grounds that that way all of the books that aren't selling enough copies to really matter will go out of copyright and people can use them freely, whereas the small one, the minority that are really doing well will stay in copyright. So that would be an interesting. And I gather, I think Landis and Posner, I think at some point, I think someone mentioned in here made a proposal along those lines. I think it was probably Landis and Posner. But on the Ray Patterson thing, one of the questions, which actually the book mentioned, but also it occurred to me, was he seems to be going back and forth between claiming that you don't want government to be the one that pays people to write books because that would have bad effects, and saying, yeah, but actually it's all right, the government, maybe we need some government subsidy to get little seen views out there, little seen views which the government likes, presumably. But in general, he's arguing, several people are arguing basically for rules, true of another, one of the later writers as well, for copyright as being the best way of maintaining an intellectually diverse environment of publications. Going on a little bit further on that question, it seemed to me that the claim about the faults of patronage was really badly overstated, because it was put as patronage means only the views of the elite get published. But that assumes there's one elite. Think about the question of who subsidizes political ideology at the moment. All right. Is there an elite that includes both Soros and the Koch brothers? For those people who aren't familiar with this, the Koch brothers are a very wealthy pair of libertarians who subsidize some of what they're doing pretty clearly just because they're businessmen is just bribing politicians by making campaign contributions, but they also subsidize various publications and, you know, groups that do research and so forth, like Cato Institute, for anybody who knows about Cato Institute. And Soros is a very, very wealthy, successful speculator who spent a fortune trying to defeat George Bush in his second term. And then there's the Rockefeller Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation. So if you imagine for a moment a world where you don't have copyright and where it's a modern version of the patronage model, it isn't really clear that that's as bad a model as everybody assumes, because there are an awful lot of different people in a modern society who have the resources to be patrons with different access to grind. So you would get some subsidy by left-wingers and some subsidy by right-wingers and some subsidy by centrists and some subsidy by religious fanatics of one sort or another, and some the Saudis would doubtless subsidize stuff, and atheists. I'm sure there is somewhere an atheist millionaire and probably an atheist billionaire. I think I may even know of one. So that if you think about it, you'd get a much more diverse world than most of these discussions. Whether it's as diverse as the one we get with copyright, I'm not sure. Because the counter-argument would be, look, if books are expensive to produce, you can't produce a book unless you would expect to sell quite a lot of copies. And so maybe the diversity produced by the requirement a million people have to want to read this might be less than the diversity produced by somebody's got to be willing to donate $5,000 to this. I'm not sure. But it did seem to be a question that a lot of people were slipping off. And I thought particularly bizarre the claim that one of the problems with advertising, they're talking now not about books but about things like television, is that it's skewed towards those with the financial wherewithal to buy advertised products. How large a fraction of the U.S. population do you think, not counting small children, does not have the financial wherewithal to buy some advertised products? If you think about what things are advertised. 1%? Maybe? All right. If you think, look at ads. The ads are not mainly for Rolls Royces. You know, the ads are for toilet paper and for chicken and, you know, for mass market clothing. You don't see a whole lot of television ads for whatever is the latest Paris fashion, except the third generation knockoff being sold cheaply by Costco or their equivalent. So I thought that was sort of a bizarre and somewhat silly statement. And I should say I also thought rather bizarre the claim that, quote, copyright's fundamental purpose is to underwrite political competency. It's not in the Constitution. No mention in the Constitution that reason exists. Does it describe the real world? If you think about, of all of the books that are published that people read, what percentage of them are giving you information to make you a better informed voter? 1%? 2%? Right? Read with a skeptical mind. I mean, my reaction is this guy is a nut, the guy who's writing it. He knows what he cares about, and he therefore sees the world through these very, very narrow lenses, where 1% of the publication is the real reason. The other 99%, that's just sort of experimental error. So I think that's a very implausible, at least to me. Not that it isn't a good feature. I mean, I don't object to saying one nice thing about copyright as opposed to, take the opposite extreme. Suppose we had a system where all publication was by the government. That's a pretty scary system. All right? And in fact, one of the arguments that's made against socialism in general is if the government owns all the printing presses, you can't get anything printed that the government doesn't like. If they own all the paper suppliers and so forth. And there are real examples. I think during World War II in England, I think there were cases where they were allocating paper because, you know, there were shortages and things, and where books that were arguing for things the government didn't like somehow didn't get any paper allocated to them. So that part is right. I think in a society like ours where there is a very diverse group of people and organizations with money, it's not just the billionaires, it's also the corporations, each of which has its own different axe to grind, that in a world like that, it seems to me that even without copyright, you would have a lot more diversity with government running it, and copyright then adds some additional, you know, useful diversity. Because of course, even with copyright, Coke and Soros can still subsidize things if they want to, and of course they do. People like that too. Coke brothers do, I don't know if Soros does, probably. but in any case, the one very minor point that struck me in that passage, and actually in the book as well, which seemed to me a little odd, was they kept referring to the neoclassicist view of copyright, where they're pretty clearly talking about people like Landis and Posner. And that version of economics is called neoclassical, not neoclassicist. And so I guess, to me at least, it sounds like a tin ear, but maybe it's just the difference between how philosophers refer to it and how economists refer to it. The part of what I thought was interesting in the Waldron piece was he starts out with what's essentially a criticism of utilitarianism, an intuitive. People familiar with the idea of utilitarianism, the idea that basically the right criterion is something like does it maximize total happiness? And, you know, there are different variants. There's average happiness or summed happiness or everybody, whatever, but the general idea. And he says, well, you know, this sounds pretty nice if we're saying we're going to do something positive. We're going to give authors a reward in order to increase total happiness. Doesn't sound so nice if we say we're going to do something to people in order to increase total happiness. So you then have sort of the standard, one of the standard anti-utilitarian critiques is you're a surgeon. You have five patients. Four of them could have their lives saved by an organ transplant, different organ for each one. Fifth one is perfectly healthy, but, you know, due to whatever's happening, he happens to be unconscious at the moment. You know, you're checking him out. Should you disassemble him, save four lives, sacrifice one life? All right, most of us are into it. No, you shouldn't. That's murder. And yet, it looks like the utilitarian argument, at least if you're not going to get caught, you can always claim you had a heart attack on the table or something, and you then took advantage of the organs conveniently available for your other four people. The utilitarian argument would be, look, unless you have some reason to believe his life is much, he's happier, or somehow makes other people happier than the other ones, you ought to do it. So that's the kind of argument which says, utilitarianism feels fine if we feel as though we're doing things for people. It feels very uncomfortable if we feel as though we're doing things to A in order to increase the happiness of B, C, D, and E. And then what's interesting about that from my standpoint in terms of the IP discussion is the way in which that then feeds into the question we started with about natural rights versus something else. That if you're different way of putting it is that an interesting issue in a lot of these discussions is what you think of as the default. What if we are intervening, we're intervening to change what? And that was in part of the point that Coase was making with regard to railroads throwing sparks, that do you assume that laissez-faire means that railroads can throw sparks and not be liable, or do you assume the laissez-faire means no, they're liable just like anybody else. They violated the property rights of the farmers who they started fires in the fields with their sparks. And so a lot of these things, if you think about a lot of political issues, do you say, really taxing the rich to help the poor, that's pretty objectionable, you're taking people's money away from them. Or do you say, why are the rich people entitled to be rich anyway? You know, there's just this stuff out there. Why should we have a system that gives rich people more than it gives poor people? And those are two different ways of thinking about it. And both of them are sort of embedded in our political rhetoric in a sense. And it's not clear that there's a really adequate philosophical justification for either of them. But it affects a lot how you look at political issues, what you think of as if we do nothing, what happens? What's the default? What's the zero point? Where are you starting? And I think that's a point which often isn't made and is worth thinking about when you're looking at these things. Let me go on a bit to Landis and Posner, with whom I co-taught an IP course many, many years ago when I was at Chicago. One of the terms they use, which may or may not be obvious to you, is when they refer to an ex ante view. And the distinction, ex ante means before, in advance, versus ex post, which is after. So to take a different example, suppose you're trying to prevent traffic accidents. An ex ante approach would be enforcing speed limits. because that's something you were doing before the accident occurs. An ex post approach would be to say, if you are in an accident, bad things will happen to you. We won't allow you to insure against accidents. We'll make you liable for the other party. Something that's ex post, in that the actual cost only occurs after the accident. Now, of course, the reason to do it is ex ante, in the sense the idea is you know that if you have an accident, bad things will happen, so you'll drive more carefully. So in that sense, they're both trying to deter, but they are different approaches. And similarly, if you think about law in general, the ex ante approach says we look at this case in terms of the effects of people's, of the incentives on people in the future, its effect in advance, whereas the ex post approach says something has happened, how do we straighten it out? So if you're thinking in terms of justice, it may make more sense to think in the ex post terms, to say, all right, A, B, C did these things, this happened, now what does who owe who? Whereas if you're thinking in terms of incentives, in terms of getting people to behave in ways that won't make bad things happen, it's more natural to think ex ante. Right, to say the reason we execute murderers is not because it does anything for the murderer, but so that other people won't commit murders. Right. Sort of standard view. So that's a distinction which is, I thought was at least worth mentioning and isn't always made clear. So then you have the argument which you're getting with both Littman and Landis and Posner about IP as an input into IP, essentially. And part of the question, which neither of them, at least in the excerpt, is making clear, is what version of copyright law they're imagining. That is to say, suppose we're talking about current copyright law. All right? Current copyright law protects expression, but not idea. So in current copyright law, if Lippman says, look, that work wasn't really original, you got your idea for your character from such and such. I say, yeah, I did, but that's idea, not expression. So I'm not claiming any right over what I produce that I'm violating with regard to what other people have produced. All right, Lippman is sort of, in some sense, suggesting that when the author claims a copyright on his novel, he's really cheating. Because he's claiming I have a right over my novel, but the person from whom I stole the idea for this character doesn't have a right over their novel. And I should say, the stealing is real in the sense I can think of one of my characters in one of my novels where the personality was really modeled on a secondary character in a novel I like by somebody else. And a different one which I've never finished where one of the characters is basically lifted from a historical novel by someone else. So people do use ideas from other things all the time. But if the copyright law says other people are free to model their characters on mine, other people are free to model their environment, as long as they don't come too close, as long as it is identified, well, then I can say, why should you complain that I'm doing it with them? And in effect, I think, and maybe Lippman makes it clear in parts that we aren't reading, that her argument is really an argument against a copyright law so wide that it covered not only expression, but all the rest of it. And then you could plausibly say, yes, what you are claiming, if you concede the claim to other people, then you're violating their copyright just as you object to people would be violating yours. And similarly in the Landis and Posner case, because there's Landis and Posner, it was interesting, because in a sense, they want to make, in that, I think, the main restriction on copyright be the idea of the trade-off between copyright as output, between IP as output and IP as input. And I think it's very hard if you're thinking about restrictions on term of copyright, for example. Notice, by the way, that one of the places where this moral rights issue comes in is if you believe it's a natural right, it's not clear why there should be any limit to the term. Right? If there's no limit to the term over how long I own my house that I've built, at least under U.S. law. If I made it so it's mine, well, it should be mine and my descendants from now till eternity, is sort of the natural intuition. And it looks as though the Landis-Posner argument they're making there for limiting it really seems to be because not limiting it means other people can't use your IP as an input. And there are doubtless cases where that's true. If you imagine, again, my original book, which is a book of readings. If we take, for example, our textbook, all right, our textbook required permission from the authors of all the things you're reading, except Macaulay is out of copyright, but I think almost all the things you're reading in order to do it. So there was some cost there. But when you're doing something on that scale, it's not that big a hassle to get the permission. Whereas if you're incorporating bits and pieces, you wouldn't, under ordinary copyright law, be violating anybody's copyright, and there it would be a pain. So I'm not sure how strong that argument is. Now, you might say, I think part of what's implicit in Larry Lessig's bit, which we unfortunately aren't reading enough to really know what his argument is. If you read the quote from Larry, it's really a conclusion, not an argument. And he's claiming that with the new technology, the expansion of copyright law is going to prevent creativity. That's his thesis. Well, you can imagine that. If you say, look, what are the interesting kinds of creativity? The interesting kind of creativity is going to be the person who patches together pieces from a published movie to make a movie of himself. Imagine a parody, for example. Suppose I do a movie where I take some very well-known movie and I then have the characters use different lines, or I put in some other things. And you could certainly imagine interesting works of art that were done that way. I'm not sure it's a very important one, but I think Larry would at least argue that with the new technology where you can make movies on your home computer, we're moving more and more to where existing art is a major input. Then it's a lot easier to do a pastiche of existing things than to hire actors and so forth, and therefore it's getting in the way. Don't know if he's right or not, but it's an interesting point. It seems to me that do people know what scenes à faire are, by the way? Some do, some don't. The scenes à faire doctrine, roughly speaking, says that if some otherwise copyrightable element has become such that it's more or less the only way of saying something, that then it's not protected by copyright. So that a standard example, although I don't think one that would really be protected by copyright anyway, is magnolias as a symbol of the Old South. The scent of magnolias, presumably going back to whatever that very famous Civil War novel, is sort of a symbol of that. But if you could imagine that there's only one way of saying something, then the argument is that that's not covered by copyright. But there's a very simple explanation going back to the straightforward economic argument, and that goes back to the question of whether or not you're depleting the commons. All right, if you go back to the argument which says part of the reason we are more generous with copyright than we are with patent is there's no significant chance that I'll write the same novel you would write, therefore you're writing a novel and copyrighting it doesn't restrict my abilities. If there's only one way of saying something, then you're copyrighting that. That's restrict my abilities. I can no longer say something I would have said myself. So it seems to me that's a fairly simple explanation. And similarly, Littman, I guess, goes into this long extended discussion of the fantasy writer who discovers that six other people have written fantasies with similar themes. That's fine, but that goes back to the point I made a long time ago about fuzzy boundaries, that one of the reasons why patent law is harder to defend than copyright law is that ideas have fuzzy boundaries. It therefore is hard to know if you're trespassing, that the story she's telling is exactly the same story as the inventor who comes up with an idea and has to do a patent search to see whether he's violating anybody's patents. That's the story she's telling for copyrights. So it seems to me that all of that gives a straightforward kind of economic cost-benefit basis for not protecting plot ideas but protecting literal expression, which is exactly what we do. And going back to the whole idea where you didn't really create it, you used other people's stuff, the response to that is we have commons, we have private property. Certain features of what I do will go into the commons, and certain features become private property. As long as I take stuff that's in the commons for everybody to use, there's no less of it available after I take it than before. Anybody else can model their character on the same character I'm modeling mine on. What I added was all mine, and therefore, taking stuff that I legitimately have, adding something and producing something is all mine. I mean, that seems to be the counter-argument to that line of argument. Going back a bit, let me talk a bit about Macaulay. Anybody know anything else about Macaulay other than this reading? When my daughter was very, very young, I used to put her to sleep to Horatius at the Bridge, which is probably Macaulay's most famous poem. And the result was that at some point we're driving at night at, she's, I don't know, 2 or something, and from the back seat there comes this little voice saying, Lars Porthena of Clusium, by the 9 gods he swore that the great house of Tarflun should suffer wrong no more, and so forth, which was quite funny. But anyway, it's good poetry. It's, you should not take it as very serious history, because it's the sort of epic conflict where, you know, it hinges on great fighters and such. But it's a fairly famous story. Anyway, but I thought it was sort of amusing because Macaulay, in passing, is talking about how you're not going to get enough literature out of wealthy elites who do it just for the fun of it. But he himself is a wealthy elite who did it just for the fun of it. He wrote a 5-volume history of England. He wrote a bunch of poetry, which a few of us still read, and so forth. He's not a very good economist. His argument, when he claims that if you have 60 years protection, the cost to readers is twice that of 30 years protection, that isn't true, because there will be many more people who want to read a book in the first 30 years after it's published than in the next 30 years. Furthermore, if you think about it in terms of investments, $1,000 40 years from now is worth less to me than $1,000 now. Similarly, the cost of having to pay more for a book 40 years from now is a lower cost to me than the cost now, because you can take a dollar now and put invested at interest and it'll be $6 by then, or whatever it is. So that's what it seems to me is wrong. And that when he says, look, extending copyright is a terrible idea because it gives a trivial benefit to the author, but a large cost to other people. That in fact, the same reasons why the benefit is trivial to the author also means the cost is usually trivial. That is to say, A, there won't be any people who want to read the book, so the author won't get much money out of his royalties, and there isn't much cost to having the book expensive, and furthermore, long in the future, you've got to discount it back to present values. That applies to both the cost and the benefit. So I thought that stuff was sort of bogus, although entertaining. Furthermore, it's not the case that the author can't get any income from royalties after his death, because the author can sell his copyright. So the author at 80 can go to a publisher and say, how would you like to buy from me all my future royalties? All right, and if your book was really still selling, you could make such a deal. So you can, in fact, get income from after your death and spend it before your death. On the other hand, I don't know if anybody else had this reaction, but part of my reaction was that Macaulay writes an awful lot better than modern academics do. That speech really was decent writing. I mean, it's clear. He doesn't use obscure words. He makes his points elegantly, even when they're wrong. So that I was contrasting between that and one of the later readings. A tax on innocent pleasures is a premium on vicious pleasures. Isn't that a great line? He's saying, look, reading is the most innocent of pleasures. And if we make books expensive, people can't afford to read, and who knows what they'll be up to then. A tax on innocent pleasures is the premium on vicious pleasures. Compare that to, we have also come to appreciate the socio-political valency of much expression, which was one of my many examples of what struck me as tortured academic writing in some of the stuff we're reading. Other things that are worth mentioning. I guess one sort of issue which comes up a little bit in some of the things, I think Lippmann is mentioning and maybe some other people, is whether IP protection ought to depend on quality. Whether you should say, since the idea of IP is to encourage output, no point in encouraging stuff that's worthless, so therefore you ought to have to meet some standard. And it's a real issue in terms of questions such as, is a phone book protectable? What kind of originality do you need? And as you probably know, it really has been a litigated issue, how much originality you need for something to count as copyright. I don't think it's been a litigated issue whether it's worth reading or not. And of course the counter argument there is, we don't really care if you have a copyright in a book that nobody wants to read, because we're going to have to pay you any money for it because they don't want to read it. And that goes back to an issue in patent law. The question is, in patent law, do you have to show that the patented idea is actually good for anything, is actually useful? That's the term in the literature. And the 19th century answer is no. that the 19th century, you've got this wonderful passage where a fairly famous 19th century judge is saying, basically, if it's useless, we don't care if you have a patent. It doesn't matter. It won't hurt anybody. That what he says useful means is not positively evil. So you don't get a patent on a device to promote debauchery or private assassination. Those are his examples. So that means Viagra can't be patented, according to him. I think nowadays we have a wider view of the subject. You can patent devices that the CIA will use to kill people, or that James Bond will, because he's a government servant, but you can't patent things for private assassination, according to at least Story, who's the judge in question. And similarly here, the counter-argument, it seems to me, would be that we don't care. But you might have. What about, suppose you took seriously the idea that the real purpose of the copyright law was to encourage political diversity. You might say, well, if you're writing trash, if you're writing romances, we aren't going to give you a copyright. That doesn't do anything at all for political diversity. Why should we bear any cost? We will only give copyrights to books like my books, which promote political diversity, or books of other people with other views. So that would be a possible position, although I don't think anybody can answer that. All right, I think we're about out of time at this point. And I think I forgot. Did I forget? No, I did not forget.